Frank, first question. Why did you decide to make a documentary about a film that was never made?
Because it's not, to me, this is not just a film that was never made. This is the greatest film never made. And this is also the most influential film never made. And both those statements sound kind of insane, but I believe them in my heart to be completely true.
Well, let's talk a bit about the first of those statements. Why do you believe this to be the greatest film never made?
I think that it's also the most fully realized film that was never realized. It really comes down to the whole story behind it, to, you know, this man, Alejandro Jodorowsky, and the, you know, the previous films that he had made, most notably El Topo and The Holy Mountain. And then he tried to do his big screen adaptation of a giant science fiction novel called Dune. And he didn't do it by himself. He hired this amazing team of as he calls them, spiritual warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And they spent a good 2 years in Paris of just working and designing everything. And the whole film is done. The whole film is done on paper. It's, you know, from the first scene to the last scene, there's over 3,000 images. And every, you know, vehicle has been drawn out and spaceships and clothing. And everything is truly done. And it was just so incredibly adventurous. It was just such a high level of creativity that I still see the ramifications of that work today and the reverberations in films as recently as of 2 years ago.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that because I have questions about its influence and legacy later. But first, just to back up a second,
sure.
Jodorowsky is probably best known for his 1970 cult film El Topo, correct? This is, in fact, wasn't it this film that gave him the nickname the father of the midnight movie?
Correct. That is it's widely known as being the very first midnight movie. So he is the creator of that of that bit of weirdness.
Yeah. What? Tell me a bit about that bit of weirdness.
He set out to make a Western, and what he said he ended up with was an Eastern. And it's kind of this bizarre metaphysical journey of this gunfighter, essentially. And he brought it here to New York. He shot it in Mexico, and he brought it here to New York, and it started to screen 7 nights a week at midnight at a movie theater in Manhattan. And it started to get all this acclaim, and all these interesting people would come, including John Lennon and all sorts of, you know, wild counterculture people of the time. And literally for 7 nights a week, it played to completely sold out audiences exclusively at midnight.
Wow.
Which was kind of the start of a whole new world of cinema.
Yeah. And Jodorowsky, besides directing it, he also wrote it, and he stars as the gunslinger, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So how did Jodorowsky go from El Topo and the follow-up film, The Holy Mountain, to becoming interested in turning Frank Herbert's 1965 epic science fiction novel, Dune, into a film?
He said it came to him as a divine inspiration. When he was asked by his producer, what do you want to do? He said, Dune. And at that point, he had not read the novel. He had heard that it was a good book. But he really knew nothing about it. But he says that I could have said anything at that moment. I could have said Don Quixote, or I could have said Hamlet. But he said Dune. And that was just the first of his many divine inspirations, as he would say.
Yeah. Early on in the film, Alejandro Jodorowsky, he says he didn't read Dune, but that he has a friend who says it was fantastic. And that raises the question, did he ever read it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, in the film, he speaks then about, you know, trying to describe the book and how it's such a dense read. In the first 100 pages, you really don't even understand what's going on. But he knows the book inside and out, because then he spent 2 months in a castle all by himself in France in order to write the screenplay adaptation of the book. So while his film version of Dune definitely varies, and sometimes varies wildly from the source material novel, it is very much Frank Herbert's Dune as well.
Mm-hmm. What do you think attracted him to Dune?
I don't know. The lights from the heavens. I don't know. I wonder how much sway this person who told him it was good had on him.
Yeah,
because
obviously
he really
a lot,
didn't
I'm
know.
Thinking.
He really didn't know much about it, but if you read Dune, it's kind of right up his alley. You know, there's a weird psychedelic drug called Spice, which basically controls the universe.
Yeah,
all
Melange.
These things that are very much.
Yeah,
Melange. And it's all kind of really up his psychedelic alley, especially at the time.
Yeah, and I haven't read it, so fill me in a little bit. I know you mentioned earlier it's hard to describe, but it's like two warring planets and families fighting over this spice called Melange kind of thing?
Basically, yes. There's this planet. It's set about 20... the novel Dune is set in the year 20,000-something, mm-hmm. and it takes place on this desert planet called Arrakis, and the only thing that Arrakis has to offer is the most important thing in the entire universe, which is the spice called Melange. So not only is it a drug that allows strange things to happen, but it's really it's what allows inter-universal space travel, mm-hmm. basically. It allows, as they say in the book, space and time to be folded so that you can travel light years in the blink of an eye, which is really what, you know, I guess the galaxies of the year 20,000-something are based on. So it becomes this very important commodity in the universe, the most important commodity. And it's really about these warring families who are trying to control the spice and to control this planet, which offers this.
Mm, yeah. At one point in your document...
And it's also like an allegory for oil and all sorts of amazing weird things.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just kind of goes on and on and on.
Yeah. At one point in your documentary... Jodorowsky says that when you make a picture, you must not respect the novel. And he goes on to say that he was raping Frank Herbert, but with love. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, he was really looking at the book as literature, not as a manual. You know, he was not looking to do a page-to-screen adaptation.
Mm-hmm. And he talks about that in your documentary. He talks about that, how you cannot – a book is not a – a movie, that they're two different beasts kind of thing, doesn't he?
He does, but so many people seem to kind of forget that. And they read a book and they love it, and then they see the film version and they don't like the film version because the film version is not what they imagined in their head. And I don't know how anybody can fully represent what's in your head on screen. They can only represent what's in their head and what's in their imagination.
Yeah.
So he definitely took, I'd say, more than his share of liberties in changing the story, but he did it all for a good cause, I suppose.
Yeah, and I'm kind of curious because prior to this, El Topo and The Holy Mountain, his two previous films, he wrote those himself. So I'm kind of curious, why he didn't just come up with his own story? Why he just didn't write, rather than rely on Frank Herbert's Dune as source material? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I believe that I can't remember the title, but I believe that The Holy Mountain is actually based on, I'm blanking on the name of the story, of course, on the radio is where I'm blanking on it.
But, okay.
So that's kind of like an adaptation, in a way as well. But he just kind of takes this, I suppose maybe it's sort of, maybe he took it more as inspiration than anything.
Yeah.
Kind of the way that
point.
His work inspired other people,
sure.
Yeah. Years on down the line.
Yeah. What did he want to achieve by making Dune? For him, this wasn't just making a film, was it?
No. As he says in the film, he said he wanted this film to be a prophet. He truly wanted it to be a god, a cinematical god. And he wanted to change the world. He wanted to change the minds of all the people who come to see it. That's kind of a recurring theme in his films.
Yeah.
This sort of, alchemical transformation.
Yeah.
And that's what he believes art is. He says the worst thing in the world is for somebody to walk into a movie theater and to come out 2 hours later unchanged, to mm-hmm. be the same person. He wants you to have, a shock when you see his film and to change your life and to see everything in a completely different way. He says that's the goal of art, is to be transformative.
Yeah, it's almost like, yes, the way he speaks about the film with such, making the film with such religious fervor, it's almost as if he's trying to invent this new way, using the film as a way of elevating the audience's consciousness, I guess, in the same way that the characters in Dune use Melange to kind of elevate
their
consciousness. Yeah.
And when I see his older films, when I see The Holy Mountain or El Topo, no matter how many times I see it, I am changed. I see new things, and I think of the world differently. I mean, his work is really the most powerful films that I've ever witnessed.
Yeah, he has that great quote about, if you wouldn't mind paraphrasing it, I'll I'll probably put a clip in here about the great quote he has about wanting to make a film that would give people who took LSD.
He says that he wanted to make a film that would create the hallucinations that people have when they take LSD, but without taking LSD. So he basically wanted people to go into the theater and have a sort of hallucinogenic, psychedelic experience brought on just by his film.
Jodorowsky describes in your film, Frank, he describes his collaborators, Jodorowsky describes his collaborators as spiritual warriors. Who were these spiritual warriors and how did he track them down?
He was, what I find really interesting about him is that he went outside the film system. You know, he was not looking for people that had worked on great movies that he liked. He was looking for great artists. He looks at film as cinema as being one of the highest forms of art. So he was looking for true artists, for true warriors that would help him in his quest. So he found artists. He found fine artists. He found a gentleman named Mobius, who was France's most famous and most acclaimed comic book artist. And he brought on Mobius to do all the storyboards for his films. And he brought on a British artist named Chris Voss, who was famous for doing the covers of pulpy British sci-fi novels in these crazy, amazing colors. And he would do all these wild-looking spaceships, of which we still have not seen in films. And then he also brought on H.R. Giger, who was this, you know, who was this extremely dark, surrealistic Swiss painter. And he, of course, went on to great acclaim and great fame by creating all of the aliens and all the artwork for the film Alien, which really is an incredibly influential film, especially visually. So but he saw something in these people that nobody else had yet seen, and brought them on to come and work with him. He was thinking he needed special effects for his film, of course, for a science fiction film. How can you not have special effects? And he wanted to go to the top guy in the world, which was Douglas Trumbull. And Douglas Trumbull is still probably the top special effects person in the world.
Yeah, didn't he do Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
He did 2001.
2001, yeah.
He did everything from 2001 up until Tree of Life a couple of years ago. He did all the amazing visuals in that film. And Jodorowsky thought, well, let's go to the main guy. Let's go to the best guy there is. But he did not find that Douglas Trumbull was his spiritual warrior. He thought that Douglas Trumbull was doing this for the money and was a businessman, and he could not possibly work with a businessman. So he went the polar opposite way. And instead of getting the most accomplished person, he found a gentleman named Dan O'Bannon, who was an incredible creative genius. But at that point, had really only worked on a little tiny science fiction film called Dark Star, which was essentially John Carpenter's USC thesis film.
Right.
But it's all based on instinct, and Jodorowsky saw something in him and saw something in his spirit and saw something in his work that said that you are my spiritual warrior.
Yeah. He also wanted to get Salvador Dali and Orson Welles involved, didn't he?
He did. He had Salvador Dali attached to be in the film. He had Orson Welles attached. He had David Carradine. Jodorowsky's own 12-year-old son, Brontis, was set to star. He had Pink Floyd, who was going to do the music. I mean, this truly would have been an incredible, incredible film.
Yeah, and a French band called Magma to do the music as well. They were going to do some music too.
An extremely wild French prog rock band called Magma was going to be doing the music for the bad guys, basically, the Harkonnens, which was the planet which was going to be composed of Giger's designs and was going to have Orson Welles be their leader. So it would have been quite extraordinary.
Yeah. How did the negotiations with Dali go?
The negotiations with Dali were probably Jodorowsky's most challenging part. As he says, he had to seduce Dali. He basically had to chase him all over the world. He first met him in New York, and then he had to go to Barcelona, and then he had to go to Paris, and then he had to go back to Spain, and he kept chasing him each time, trying to convince him that, you know, that you are the only person in the world who can play the mad emperor of the universe. And really, who is better to play the mad emperor of the universe than
Salvador? Absolutely. Salvador. He was already playing that part, pretty much.
in his normal life.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was this, as it says in the film, that Dali wanted to make a lot of money out of doing this, so they had to reach a kind of compromise.
Dali wanted to be the highest paid actor in Hollywood. That's what he was. That was his dream. So he was demanding $100,000 an hour to be in the film, which is, you know, which is a rate that it's impossible, especially in 1970s dollars.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Afford?
Yeah,
I'd be impossible. Yeah, we'd be 10-hour day would be $1 million.
Yeah.
So then they kind of renegotiated, and they came back, and they figured out that he would be in the film for somewhere between 3 to 5 minutes of actual screen time. So they went back to him and they said, okay, we will pay you $100,000 per used minute on screen, which would end up being less money, but it allowed Dali to say that he is the $100,000 per minute actor.
Yeah.
Which is really the greatest thing in his mind ever.
Yeah. Didn't he also, Dali, want a burning giraffe to be used in the film?
He wanted everything. He just kept upping the stakes. He, you know, burning giraffes are kind of a recurring motif in some of his paintings. So he wanted giraffes. He wanted elephants. He wanted helicopters. You know, he wanted access to these things in his life. He just wanted more and more grandiose things, thinking they would finally give up and say, okay, Dali, you've bested us. You will not be in the film. But they just kept giving into everything. Like, sure. Basically, Jodorowsky was like, I will do anything to make this film happen. He said he would sacrifice himself. He would cut off his own arms to make this film. He would die to make this film. So a little, you know, kind of an outrageous request from Dali was certainly not going to deter Jodorowsky in any way.
Yeah. So how did Jodorowsky and his producer, Michel Seydoux, am I saying that right? Michel Seydoux?
Yes, correct. Yeah. Michel Seydoux.
Let me just ask the question again. How did Jodorowsky and his producer, Michel Seydoux, pitch the film to Hollywood executives?
Well, they spent that 2 years in Paris, you know, drawing everything out. And they basically took this entire storyboard book and compiled it all together and bound it together and made a bunch of copies and took it with them to Los Angeles, to the studios. And they had most of their financing, but they needed to find not only U.S. money, but a real U.S. partner. You know, they really needed a studio to be their partner in the film to get that American distribution, to get it in front of those American eyeballs. Because without it, no matter how successful it would be in France, without having the U.S. behind it, it just would not have been the world-changing film that they needed it to be.
Yeah.
So they came to Hollywood. You know, they came to Hollywood with these amazing ideas for this science fiction film in a time when Hollywood did not believe in science fiction films. This is before Star Wars. This is before all of this. The only thing that existed was really 2001 and little B movies.
Yeah, and so they kind of
nothing
thought
of this.
Yeah,
yeah. Nothing
they kind
of this
thought
nature.
Was, yeah, 2001. That was it. That was the zenith of sci-fi movies, science fiction movies, and there was nothing left to do, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, what is 2001? Is it sci-fi or is it real science? Almost,
yeah,
you know, it's
a good
kind of
question,
this very
yeah.
realistic.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, lots of metaphysical ideas, obviously, in there.
Yeah.
But it was not this kind of big budget, swashbuckling tale that Dune is in so many ways.
Yeah, and this book, this huge book of storyboards and artwork, which we see in the film, and Jodorowsky holding it, and we see close-ups of some of the beautiful art in it, but we really can't emphasize how big it is, how much of a blunderbuss it is. It's like four or five of Stephen King's biggest books put together in terms of how thick and impressive it is.
Yeah, I mean, the book itself must weigh 10 pounds. Mm. I mean, it's just a beast of a thing to lug around. And they made a whole bunch of copies of them. They brought them to the studios to say, hey, what do you think?
Yeah.
You know, my previous movies are El Topo and Holy Mountain, and this is my new film.
Yeah, and that all the storyboards.
Let's make it together.
Yeah, exactly. Why not? Yeah, yeah. So why wasn't he able to make Dune?
I believe in my heart that he was unable to make Dune because he was too far ahead of the times. I believe that he was trying to make this big budget science fiction space opera before there was such a thing, you know, before Star Wars proved that economically that's a smart idea. And that's really what the studios were interested in is, of course, money. They were interested in the economics of a film.
Yeah.
So when he came to them with this idea, they just thought it was silly, just like they thought Star Wars was silly. You know, when George Lucas and Gary Kurtz were working on Star Wars in 1976, 1977, when it was finally released, until it was released, the studio thought it was ridiculous, thought it was stupid, and was looking for any excuse to kind of reduce their budget or pull their plug or just get them out of their hair. And then, of course, when Star Wars comes out, and for better or for worse, when it comes out, and it changes the landscape of movies and makes a, you know, bajillion dollars. And we've got, you know, right now in 2014, we've got, they're working on parts 7, 8, and 9.
Yeah.
And all of these other science fiction movies came out, and suddenly every science fiction movie could get made because there was money in it. And let's get these kids who these films are truly aimed at to come and see these films so we can get rich. But he was before that. They didn't think that Dune was, especially Jodorowsky's Dune, was a financially viable film. And that's really what scared them off.
Yeah. What do you think? If he had been able to make his version of Dune, if the suits, the Hollywood executives could have, you know, were kept up with him and his ideas, how do you think it would have been received?
I mean, that's the interesting question. You know, it's you know, we are on the, there's different timelines, I think, in the universe. And depending on what you choose today, that timeline changes. And we are on the one, we are on the timeline where Jodorowsky's Dune was not completed. But there's another timeline, I think, that exists where his film was completed. And even there, that timeline can split. And let's say his film was completed and was a success. Let's imagine that it was the greatest, biggest movie ever, and everybody went to go see it 10 times, and
yeah,
there was, you know, lines
yeah,
around the block.
Yeah.
What would that have proved to the studios? You know, that would have proved to them that bizarre, avant-garde, European-style science fiction films were are viable and will make money. So maybe the big tentpole films every year that the studios come out with would be more avant-garde, more artistic, less comic book.
Yeah. I want to get on that timeline. How do we make, yeah, how do we make that
kind
timeline
of interesting
happen?
But yeah, then also, I mean, let's say his Dune had been created and been a failure. Let's say it had been a disaster. Let's say it took down a studio. It was such a financial disaster. Then, you know, as we said, Fox, who had Star Wars in the pipeline, they would have used that as their first excuse to just pull that plug, and the world would not have Star Wars.
Mm.
And again, for better or for worse, a world without Star Wars, where are you? What are the big films every year? What are those big science fiction films? We probably wouldn't have these superhero films. We wouldn't have the Avengers coming out. It would be a very different landscape. Maybe it would be, you know, costume dramas of the turn of the century. It would be something very, very different than where we're living right now.
Yeah. In 1984, David Lynch's version of Dune was released. Did Jodorowsky ever see it?
He did. He, against his will, it was a very painful time, I think, because, you know, he could not realize his Dune. But then one of his favorite directors, David Lynch, somebody, you know, cut very much from the same surrealistic cloth,
yeah,
of Alejandro Jodorowsky, gets to tell the story. And what could be more painful than that? He thought, if anyone could make this movie, it would be this guy. And he did not want to go see it. He was terrified to go see it. And his sons kind of had to force him to go. And they said, okay, now it's playing here and we are warriors. We need to go together to see this film, for better or for worse. We need to face this monster. So they took him to the theater. They basically dragged him there. He said he was almost crying.
Okay.
He just really could not handle that this was reality. And he said as he was watching the film, he got happier and he got happier and happier because he felt the film was awful and that it was this tremendous failure, which then he says that and then he feels bad. And he says,
yeah,
oh, it's I don't want to say that because I love David Lynch. He's a fantastic artist. But he says this is not a David Lynch film. This does not represent him at all. This is the producers that did this. This is not Mr. Lynch.
Yeah. Even though Jodorowsky's version of Dune was never made, do you think it was an influence on films that came after?
I think it's undeniable how much interest his creations have had on science fiction, and we didn't really know that going in to make the film. You know, all we knew was that Alien came about afterwards because of these people gathering together.
But yeah, Dan O'Bannon. Dan O'Bannon and H.R. Giger.
Yeah, I mean Dan O'Bannon wrote Alien. He suggested to Ridley Scott, "Oh, you need to see this artist named H.R. Giger." And Ridley Scott saw Giger and fell in love with him, and that's the look of Alien. And they also brought on Mobius and Chris Foss, so the entire Dune team, except for Alejandro, basically worked on Alien. But then once we had this storyboard book, and once we had the time to really go through it and to really see his version of Dune, we started to come across all of these sequences that were familiar to us.
Yeah, like Star Wars.
That we'd seen.
Star Wars.
Like Everything from Star Wars to Prometheus to, you know, to Flash Gordon and Contact and even Raiders of the Lost Ark. There are sequences in these films which relate exactly back to the creations that happened in Paris in the mid-1970s with Jodorowsky and his spiritual warriors.
Yeah. What's the Star Wars sequence that relates back to Jodorowsky?
I mean, there's a couple. There's an overall feel, of course. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Dune is really all about... everyone has a sword for some reason in Dune. There's no yeah. guns. Everybody's yeah. fighting with swords. And, you know, what's the most famous things in Star Wars is these lightsabers. There's a very specific sequence in the Dune... in Jodorowsky's storyboard of Dune, of the main character, the boy, Paul, who is dueling with a robot while he's training. And when you look at the drawings, you really can't help but picture a very famous scene in the first Star Wars film of Luke Skywalker dueling with the sort of robot ball within the Millennium Falcon. And you look at the two images, and they're very similar. And that's, I think Star Wars is influenced by Jodorowsky's Dune, and I think it's influenced by Frank Herbert's Dune. I mean, would Star Wars have begun, would the film have opened on the desert planet of Tatooine if Frank Herbert's Dune was not based on the desert planet of Arrakis?
Hmm.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. I would imagine that one of the biggest challenges you faced in making Jodorowsky's Dune was that there was no film to pull clips from. So how did you deal with that?
That was the challenge.
Yeah. You know,
that was definitely the challenge. How do you make a film about a film that was never made? That was challenging. But in reality, I think I definitely side with Alejandro in thinking that the film was made. It just wasn't made the way we thought it would be. You know, it's not on the big screen. It's not starring Dali and Orson Welles. It's all on paper. But everything is there. So we could really go into the storyboard book and pull out key scenes and animate those and kind of bring those to life. So we have a documentary that consists of Alejandro Jodorowsky, who is one of the world's greatest storytellers, has a personality that you cannot help but fall in love with.
Definitely.
If you walk out of the documentary without being in love with him, then I don't think you have a soul.
Yeah.
It's just not possible.
Yeah.
And then we have all this great artwork that we can kind of bring to life and really show for the first time in a film on the big screen what was his vision way before all other people had their similar visions.
Yeah, and there is some beautiful limited animation and beautiful imagery to work with. There's an especially beautiful painting of a pirate ship that the artist Chris Foss created. I love that ship.
Yeah, Chris Foss is this wild British artist who does these incredibly colorful, amazing ships, and he did this incredible camouflaged pirate spaceship, which looks like a tropical fish more
yeah.
than anything.
Yeah.
And it's just beautiful and striking. And there's been nothing else exists like it. I've never seen anything like that in another film. It's all just really beautiful and unique imagery.
Yeah. Well, it's probably only a matter of time, especially now that your documentary's out, till we start seeing. We'll see a whole bunch of those pirate spaceships.
That'd be fantastic.
It would be.
I would love
yeah.
it if more yeah. things came out of this creation. It'd be just incredible.
Yeah. Near the end of your film, Jodorowsky says that for him to fail is only to change the way. And I'm curious if you think the fact that Jodorowsky was not able to make Dune, should we see that as a failure?
No, I don't think so. He truly believes in his heart that he made the film. You know, when he speaks about drawing the storyboards, he doesn't say drawing. He says shooting. He says, we were shooting the picture. We were shooting, and that Mobius was my camera. He really believes that the film was created. I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
Oh, yeah, no, that's great. So let me
sorry
just...
about that.
No, that's no problem. This would be great, but let me ask you...
Thank God this is the tape.
Yeah,
thank
exactly. Of course, I'm going to leave that part in. No, just kidding. Jodorowsky talks near the end of your film about somebody making his version of Dune, possibly, say, as an animated film. Do you think that we could someday see Jodorowsky's version of Dune becoming a reality, especially with the, you know, the success and with what your documentary, Jodorowsky, Dune is putting out there?
I think that is definitely a real possibility. I think that when you see the documentary, you can't help but leave the theater feeling inspired, feeling uplifted, feeling like you can take on the world and do anything. He sort of fills you. He's a real guru, is essentially what he is.
Oh, for sure.
And you leave just feeling incredible. You say you listen to Jodorowsky's words for an hour and a half, and you leave saying, I can do anything.
Exactly.
And he kind of puts this call to arms out there saying, anybody can make my film now. Anybody can take this book and make it into animation. They can do anything.
Yeah. Do you have a filmmaker? Sorry to cut you off there, Frank. Do you have a filmmaker in mind, someone you think would be a good match to do it?
Oh, I wouldn't even. I'd be too scared to say such a thing, for sure.
Okay. Jodorowsky has a new film out, The Dance of Reality, and this is his first film in 23 years. It recently premiered at Cannes. Do you think that any of the creative energy he poured into Dune somehow managed to find its way into The Dance of Reality?
I think absolutely. You know, it's really quite interesting. You know, like so many people, as we say in the documentary, so many people have taken those ideas and kind of taken those scenes and they ended up in so many other films. And he took his ideas and he put them into his comics and he put them into his other works and he put them into his subsequent films. And there's actually a sequence in the new film, in The Dance of Reality, which comes straight out of the Dune storyboards. And it happens to be a scene that we chose to animate as well. So you can really sort of compare this animated sequence to a scene that he used in a fully realized film 40 years later.
Wow. Which sequence is it?
In the Dune documentary, it's the torture of Leto, which is this interrogation sequence, this horrible, brutal interrogation sequence. And in Dance of Reality, there is a very similar sequence, although it's unfortunately Alejandro's real-life son, Brontis, being tortured, which is difficult for me to watch because I love the guy so much. But it's beautiful and amazing and wonderful.
Yeah. Well, this was great. Thank you so much, Frank. Thank you for doing this. I had we're done with the interview. Was there anything you wanted to add? I think we covered a lot, as much as we
could.
You
know, what I keep going back to is, you know, it's so interesting that that the studios didn't believe in him and, you know, he kind of came in and it's so easy to kind of laugh at him and his ideas. You know, of course, like, how are you going to make this movie when you've made El Topo and Holy Mountain, you know, when that's your filmography? And then what are the studios less than 10 years later when they actually make Dune? Who do they hire but David Lynch, who had a filmography which is essentially The Elephant Man and Eraserhead? So they kind of went back to the same ideas. And then they also laughed at him, like, he says his film was going to be 20 hours long. But that's what people want now, it seems. It seems like people will binge watch an entire episode of or entire season of a TV show on their Netflix over a weekend. So maybe he was ahead of his time.
Yeah. Yeah. So probably, that's what I was going to say. It sounds like it. Is there, Carilla, our technical director, just had a question she wanted me to ask you. Given Jodorowsky's comments and his hope that someone could still make a film based on his vision of Dune, is there any interest in publishing the book of the storyboards and the art?
There is a lot of interest in the public, for sure. Every time we do a festival screening or I do a Q&A after a screening, somebody always asks, what's happening with the book? How can I get a copy of it? So there's definitely interest. I know I would be the first person in line. I think they're trying to figure out, Michelle Sadu and Alejandro Jodorowsky, how, if it's possible, to publish the book. You know, what kind of rights do they have to go back and get from the Frank Herbert estate, let's say. But I would love to see it released in, you know, exactly the same in those dimensions, in that size, in a very limited edition, beautiful work of art. I think it would be just
it would be great.
Incredible. Yeah, I'd love to have it on my shelf.
Yeah, you and me both. I could see Tashin doing something like that. I could see it
I think Tashin was speaking with Michelle Sadu for a while. So that would be, to me, that's the company to
do for
it.
Sure. Let's hope something comes of that.
It was really a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
To talk to you. Congratulations again. Thanks a lot, Frank.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.